Existentialist, depressive, and solipsistic.
That's Kurt Beals giving us three words people often use to describe Franz Kafka. The German language author is a titan of Western literature. He's helped define modern novels and short stories. I'm Willis Ryder Arnold.
And I'm Nancy Fowler, and this is Cut and Paste. So Willis, what was your first introduction to Kafka? Maybe in high school or?
Yeah, I think I actually read Metamorphosis first. And the first time I read it, it was kind of like, you know, the traditional doom and gloom and he turns into a cockroach or whatever.
Yeah.
But my understanding of it kind of evolved over time.
I actually did not get to know Kafka in high school. I probably heard the word Kafkaesque before I ever read Kafka, which it led me to read a little bit of Kafka.
Really? So what book did you actually search out after you'd heard the word?
So I started with Metamorphosis after learning that that's the 101, I guess.
The classic.
Yeah.
Of course, this popularity means that people are always wondering about his real life.
Oh, absolutely.
Beals recently translated a book by Kafka biographer Rainer Stock that includes ephemera, notes, grocery lists, diary entries, and even a travel guide.
It's called Is That Kafka? 99 Finds, and it helps challenge the popular opinion of who Kafka was. To start us off, Beals offers three words that you might not expect to apply to this sullen writer.
Modern, witty, and charming.
Which does not sound like the same guy.
No, but there are passages here where Rainer Stach describes how Kafka could sit down at any table in a beer hall and just make friends with the people around him. He does have a number of romantic encounters that are documented here. He was obviously not your typical sort of ladies' man, but the Kafka that you see in this book is really someone who you can imagine as a full three-dimensional person, having friends, having family members who are not just the father that he had his notoriously complicated relationship with, but nieces who he wrote sweet letters to and sent birthday gifts to, that sort of thing. So you see a sort of sweet, funny, and in some ways very modern person here who has a sensibility for new technologies, new trends in things like fitness. So it really is an unexpected Kafka that you get in this book.
It struck me, you know, the language is so contemporary,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this was intended to be amusing. Or is it only in the translation that it's amusing?
The collection is intended to be amusing. Kafka and his friend Max Brot, who compiled this travel guide, or sketched out a plan for the travel guide, which they never actually realized, they meant this very seriously, and the commentary explains that they actually had an extended correspondence about it, and Kafka bugged his friend about having not offered this prospectus for a travel guide program when he was in discussions with the publisher for other things. So this was not a joke. This was actually the way that they were going to make their fortune and be able to quit their day jobs. But the commentaries and the juxtaposition of some of these texts in the collection is certainly intended to bring out what's unexpected or what's slightly absurd, not in the typical Kafkaesque way, but absurd with respect to our familiar idea of Kafka. So Kafka was not just this loner wandering around the foggy streets of Prague feeling alienated from the world. He was also someone who went to bordellos and who went to beer gardens and drank beer, and who came up with technical ideas like the answering machine. So the unexpected aspect of these anecdotes is really part of their charm.
And that's kind of like one of the reasons that this book has taken off. It's been reviewed in a bunch of different places. People have been pretty excited about it. Why do you think that's something that has really captured people's attention?
Well, I think Kafka as an author has a really disproportionate prominence in America with respect to German literature. There are very few authors who could compete with Kafka, and everyone knows something about Kafka, whether they've read Kafka or not. People at least know the story of the Metamorphosis, or they have the idea of this very creepy, non-transparent bureaucracy. The adjective Kafkaesque obviously is something that's familiar and widely abused. And so I think that what makes this book really interesting to readers who are not Kafka scholars is just that people think they have an idea of who Kafka is, and then this gives them 99 other versions of who Kafka was that don't necessarily correspond to the things that they think they know.
So, Kurt, why don't you read a passage that lets us know what this version of Kafka is really like?
How Kafka and Brod almost became millionaires. Our plan to make millions, on the cheap. A business venture worth millions. On the cheap through Italy, on the cheap through Switzerland, on the cheap in Paris, on the cheap in the Bohemian spas and in Prague. Can be translated into every language. Motto, just dare. Precision, limitations. Travelers should be spared the choice. A route for 400, 500 francs, etc. Principle of group travel, but solo. Compare to teach-yourself pamphlets. No comprehensive geography, only routes. We only name one hotel, and others in descending order in case this one is full. If tramway is available, we do not include the carriage. We recommend a precise time for the trip. Equally simple, doctors.
As you were saying earlier, you know, you're navigating several different voices in this. Mm-hmm. What sort of challenges do you have to encounter as a translator when you're not just working with Kafka, but you're working with, like, Kafka plus 20?
Well, Kafka himself is challenge enough, but I think the challenge is really to make a book that is internally coherent, but also not limited to one voice. So one temptation as a translator would be to fall into your own vocabulary and your own rhythms of prose and make all of the authors in the book sound like the same voice. And so I tried very actively to avoid that. So I tried to make Kafka Kafka, to let Rainer Stach, who is the Kafka biographer who wrote and edited this book, to let him be Rainer Stach, and then all of the other writers who are excerpted or featured in one way or another in this book, people who Kafka corresponded with, people who wrote obituaries of Kafka, someone who wrote one of the first letters ever recorded about Kafka's text to Kafka, complaining that his sister and her and his family members couldn't understand the book and they were very frustrated. And it was Kafka's responsibility to explain to him what he meant by this book. So there are all these different people's voices coming in. And so what I had to try to do was really develop a different voice for each of them, but without making this seem like a complete grab bag of unrelated texts. So there's kind of a balancing act.
So really what we find out is he's just somewhat of a regular guy.
Is he a regular guy? He is someone who shares experiences with regular people, but seems to experience them in radically different ways. So one of the things that's really striking is you see him doing these day-to-day things that people even a century later do on a day-to-day basis, and certainly a lot of his contemporaries did. But then somehow amidst this day-to-day routine that is not that different from what thousands of other people in Prague were doing, he had these completely unique ideas and unique ways of viewing his reality. It doesn't explain his literary work. You can know as much as you want about Kafka the person, and it's still not enough to know why he, unlike everyone else, was able to develop this radically original, imaginative view of the world.
And I think this might be another time to jump in with some more of what Kafka wrote himself.
So this is an excerpt from a letter that Kafka wrote to his fiancée, Felicia Bauer, who actually worked at the office of a company in Berlin that produced something called the Parlograph, which is a dictation machine. And so Kafka writes to her, "The invention of a cross between a telephone and a parlograph, it really can't be that hard. Surely by the day after tomorrow you'll be reporting to me that the project is already a success. Of course that would have an enormous impact on editorial offices, news agencies, etc. Harder, but doubtless possible as well, would be a combination of the gramophone and the telephone. Harder because you can't understand a gramophone at all, and a parlograph can't ask it to speak more clearly. A combination of the gramophone and the telephone wouldn't have such great significance in general either, but for people like me who are afraid of the telephone, it would be a relief. But then people like me are also afraid of the telephone."
What's it like to try and, like, work on something like this when it is so loaded with all of the literary history? And what is it like to encounter that and then be responsible for some of it?
Yeah, it's well, this is a very different translation project than ones that I'd done before. When you're translating Kafka, there are pre-existing translations of a lot of the texts. There are preconceptions about who he is, how he writes. And so what I did as I was translating this was I translated the whole thing from German into English without consulting all that many sources, except where I had to figure out for sure what translation is standard for a particular place name or a particular work that's been previously published. But then I went through shelves and shelves in the WashU library and found every translation I could find of any of these diary excerpts, letters that had already been published in English, and compared my translation to these pre-existing translations, because what you really don't want is you publish your translation and then somebody says, oh, you totally misunderstood what this word meant here, and this previous translator got it right. So,
sure. Has anybody ever said anything like that to you? Like, no, wait, that's not how that other translator interpreted this, and one of you has to be wrong.
For translations, often you just disappear in the review. The review focuses on the book itself and on the author, and the translator gets a line or two in a kind of throwaway paragraph that says the translation reads smoothly and aptly conveys the meaning of the text, or something that doesn't really tell you that much about the hours and hours that the translator actually spent working on this.
So how many hours did you actually spend working on this?
Well, hundreds, certainly. I think I would estimate that the first rough draft of each page took about an hour. By the time all of that's done, hundreds of hours. I kind of hate to even think how many.
Can you kind of set the scene? I mean, are you, people have favorite times to do things. Are you like sitting there at a kitchen table with a cup of coffee? Are you in front of your computer? Are you up late at night drinking a German lager?
All of the above. I think translation uses a different part of my brain than my academic research, but that part of my brain can only keep going for a couple hours at a time, and then, like many other activities, like writing, like a lot of other creative work, you can only keep the inspiration going for so long.
What do you think people can get out of recognizing that, like, some of the things that he was thinking then are actually generally real things now?
I think that one of the things that makes Kafka so relevant and so interesting to readers now is that he's writing in an age of rapid modernization, and really some of what he's responding to is the beginning or the early phase of developments that we're still seeing now in terms of certainly technological developments. He's very interested in media. As I mentioned, he comes up with the idea of the answering machine. He has stories about telephones, which are always a little bit uncanny and unsettling. But he's fascinated by media technologies and reproduction technologies. He writes about new transportation. There's a chapter in here where he's at an air show in Italy. There's a chapter about taking the metro in Paris. So he's really very consciously and intensely aware of all of these forms of modernization around him. And so I think in some ways he seems to be this kind of timeless author who exists in his own mind, but he's actually very deeply rooted in rapidly modernizing world. And so I think that we can actually identify with some things like that. And the travel guides are another example. This is an era where, thanks to trains, he can actually travel cheaply with his best friend around Europe. They go to Italy together, they go to France together, and it's much less of an undertaking than it would have been a century before. And so he's really on our side of a particular historical divide somewhere around the turn of the century.
I wonder what his Twitter handle would have been.
I'm guessing it would have had a K in it, probably just at K.
So would Kafka tweet or not? I guess we'll never know if he would have found Twitter like a way to connect with people, or if he would have found it alienating.
This is Cut and Paste, produced by Nancy Fowler
and Willis Ryder Arnold.
The music you've heard throughout the piece was created by local musician Eric Hall.
You can find Cut and Paste at stlpublicradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts.